Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bouvillo. I'm the Deputy Director and the Research Director here at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. It's a pleasure to welcome you here today for this this lecture in the Lowy Lecture Series entitled Iraq After Islamic State. It's a great pleasure for us to host today Haider Al-Khoui. Haider has been with us for, I think, just over a week. We've done a range of events with him. He's done some media. He's here as a visiting fellow, courtesy of a grant from the Council of Australia Arab Relations. And we'd like to acknowledge the Council and their support for this initiative. It's been fantastic. Haider's had a great program in Canberra, done some great media, and culminating in today's address. Haider will come up here in a moment and say a few words from the lectern, and he's brought some pictures for us as well. It's always good to have some audiovisual. And then our very own Roger Shanahan, research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, will do a Q&A with Haider, and then we'll also take some questions from the floor. Haider is an associate fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, and is also a fellow at Forward Thinking. He holds a master's degree in international studies and diplomacy from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He's our visiting fellow, as I said, supported by the Australian government through the Council for Australian Arab Relations at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Roger Shanahan is, I'm sure, well known to you all as a regular commentator in the media on Middle Eastern affairs. He's a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute. He's also a former army officer who had extensive service with the Parachute Battalion Group and has had operational service with the UN in southern Lebanon and Syria, and also service in East Timor and Beirut in 2006 during the war there, and in Afghanistan. He's a former director of the Army's Land Warfare Studies Centre and has been posted as a defence attaché to Australian embassies in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. He has an MA in International Relations and Middle East Studies from ANU and a PhD in Arabic and Islamic Studies from the University of Sydney. So please join me in welcoming first Haider and then Roger later to hold them in conversation.
Thank you very much, Anthony. And it's a pleasure to be here in Sydney. I'd like to thank the Lowy Institute for inviting me, and of course, DFAT's Council for Arab and Australian Relations for sponsoring this trip and making it possible to be with you today. So my talk is going to be about what Iraq, what Iraq looks like and what Iraq will look like after ISIS and some of the security challenges and prospects for reconciliation. First of all, in case anyone hasn't noticed, and unfortunately there are still analysts who say ISIS is resilient and ISIS is going from strength to strength, but the facts tell a very different story. This is a handout from the White House showing the territory that ISIS had in June of 2014 and the territory they control as of January. The green is the territory they've lost, and the dark red, you can see some, you know, in the top left and in Palmyra, is the territory they've gained. And actually, it's April 2016 now. Tadmor in Syria has been liberated, and the dark spots near Baghdad have also been retaken by the Iraqi army. So ISIS have lost much more territory than this map shows. They're being squeezed from all sides by a very diverse group of enemies. Syrians, Iraqis, Russians, Iranians, Americans. There's noticeably, you can see they've lost less territory in Syria than Iraq, and that's because the campaign in Syria is much more complicated. There are fewer common friends for the international community and regional countries. In Iraq, interestingly, the US and Iran are supporting the same government and they're fighting the same enemy. In Syria, the US and Iran are supporting different groups who the other considers enemy. And I'll come back to this US-Iranian interesting dynamic we're seeing. The good news is the oil industry is being systematically targeted by the US-led campaign. This is another handout from CENTCOM, the Pentagon. Their revenues and territories rapidly declining, and ISIS run mafia-like protection and extortion operations, so they tax locals. So the more the territory they're losing, The less people they're governing, the harder it is to collect revenue, and the quicker they're going to collapse as a state. And actually, this is just from the US-led coalition, so it doesn't include the thousands of airstrikes conducted by the Syrians, the Iranians, and the Russians. The collapse of ISIS, the state, the so-called state, does not mean the collapse of ISIS, the terrorist organization. So there is room for a lot of optimism, but this isn't the end of the story. They're going to remain a powerful terrorist organization that will revert back to the insurgency phase of the caliphate. So continue to act as a parasite in Syria and Iraq, leeching off state largesse. And it's important to remember, even before ISIS rose in Mosul, they were able to coerce the local population and collect taxes, even from big telecommunication and construction firms. So businesses who came to Baghdad to complain about being forced to pay out money to ISIS were just told by the Iraqi government to include this in the contracts. And of course, this is on top of the bribery and kickback. So you can try and imagine the scale of the problem and corruption Iraq is going to have to deal with even after ISIS, the state, collapses. ISIS, the acronym, stands for the Islamic States of Iraq and Syria, but it is an Iraqi organization. The leader, of course, is Iraqi. The leadership is almost exclusively Iraqi. And some of Baghdadi's most important deputies are actually major generals, lieutenant colonels in Saddam's military and intelligence forces. So one of the reasons for their success was this ability to marry a potent and cogent ideology, which I'll come back to, with a very professional military outfit. So we have crazy people from all over the world, from where I come from, the UK, and from here in Australia too, going to Syria and Iraq. But once they get there, there is a state-like security apparatus that welcomes them and facilitates their jihad. The point I stress, ISIS being Iraqi, and of course Iraqi politicians will downplay this and they try and, you know, deflect the problem to others. But the point why I say ISIS is Iraqi is because if you break ISIS in Iraq, they will crumble in Syria, and that's not the case vice versa. Interestingly, we have more and more Sunnis now in Iraq who are joining the fight in Iraq. They're working alongside American special forces, Iraqi federal troops, and even Shia militias to defeat them. This was a story run by AFP last year, and if you notice, the arm patch this gentleman is wearing is not the Iraqi security forces patch. There is no Iraqi flag. It's the patch of a Shia militia. And the green band, the green band, is again typical of Shia militias. ISIS and other Sunni jihadis wear black. So he looks like a Shia fighter, but he's actually a Sunni. And the point is, the fight against ISIS is transcending the sectarian divisions. And this quote at the bottom is actually from him. The whole world is surprised by this. It's the first time in history of Asaib, that's the unit he's fighting for, the first time in the history of Asaib that they formed a Sunni unit. The real challenge in Iraq isn't going to be the fight against ISIS, which is going in the right direction. And of course, Iraq still does need the support of the international community in its military campaign. But the post-war reconciliation is going to be more important in the long term. And where the international community can play a much more productive role in bringing disparate Iraqi groups together. Bringing communities together in Iraq who have been torn apart is a very tall order. A few months ago, I traveled to some of the territory that ISIS lost that I showed you in the north of Baghdad, areas recently liberated by the Iraqi armed forces and local tribes. And some of these places are half empty. We have homes bulldozed, hundreds of houses set alight, and they're empty because of retaliatory attacks and fear of retaliation. And this goes way beyond a Shia-Sunni problem. There's also a very fierce intra-Sunni, intra-tribal war, and the lack of trust makes this reconciliation very difficult. In Anbar province to the west of Iraq, which again was recently liberated by the Iraqi armed forces, the commander of the Iraqi army, so the actual commander of Anbar operations, which led the charge to liberate these regions to the west of Baghdad, His name is Ismail Mahallawi. He's a gentleman on the left. And you'll notice, even though it's a small picture, he looks quite like the gentleman on the right, who's Muhammad Mahallawi. And he was the ISIS's military commander in Anbar, in the same province. They're from the same tribe. They're from the same family. They're cousins, in fact. And this is actually just a high-profile case. Oh, it goes without saying, the army was successful in this operation. And the gentleman on the left's forces killed and confirmed the kill of the gentleman on the right, his cousin. And I actually asked a friend in Ramadi why clans were fighting against each other, families fighting against each other. And he said, it's not just clans. We have brothers, you know, from the same father, from the same mother, who are on different sides of this war. So you can imagine the intra-sectarian dynamics we're dealing with. Besides the military campaign, I think everyone thankfully now recognizes this is also a war of ideas. And you can't defeat ideas with just bombs. There needs to be a much more concerted effort to combat the ideology that forms the foundation of groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And of course, I say this recognizing that it is chiefly the responsibility of Muslims. It's chiefly the responsibility of the Muslim world. The West cannot and should not decide on what is good Islam and what is bad Islam, who is a good Muslim, who is a bad Muslim. But I think they can do much more to limit the influence of those spreading this hateful interpretation of Islam, even if they happen to be allies, which is the case with Saudi Arabia. ISIS, these books, which are being taught to school children as young as seven, are the same textbooks being used in Saudi Arabia and being exported by Saudi Arabia, not just across the Islamic world, but across the world. We have these books in the UK. Thankfully, the discourse is shifting. Those monitoring US-Saudi relations can see this clearly. Some of the things being said about this in American media is unprecedented. And of course, Obama's increasing public frustration with Saudi Arabia is clear. And just yesterday, he was snubbed by the king. And President Obama was greeted by a lower-ranking governor whilst the king was greeting other lower-ranking Arab officials. So ideas need to be defeated with ideas, and there's no point just defeating these groups militarily. It feels like sometimes the international community is playing whack-a-mole. You know, you hit them in Afghanistan, they pop up in Iraq. You hit them in Iraq, they pop up in Syria. Now, of course, this is problematic. Even in the days of Al-Qaeda, no one in the days of 9/11, no one would imagine or could have imagined there would be a more extreme terrorist organization. Well, now we have ISIS. And the problem is if the ideology, if these books aren't stopped being exported across the world after ISIS, as difficult as this is to imagine, we may have an even more extreme terrorist organization. My second last point I wanted to discuss in terms of the debate on ISIS is the, you know, game changer is an understatement, but the US-Iranian relationship is changing fast. It's making a lot of people, putting a lot of people in awkward positions, but it's good for the campaign against ISIS. And this cooperation, of course, this is in the context of the nuclear agreement, but it goes much beyond the nuclear agreement. Sadly, no one knows the details of the secret agreement or the agreement struck beyond the nuclear file. But we are seeing in Iraq intelligence sharing between the Iranians and Americans through the Iraqis. Two spheres of influence emerging, the South and the East under Iranian influence, the West and the North under US influence, and they're being respected. The Iranians and Americans, they went from a period of open but undeclared warfare, they were killing each other in Iraq, to a period of deconfliction before ISIS. That's a military term of being aware of each other's movements and trying to stay out of each other's way. Now it's gone much beyond deconfliction. There's cooperation. And I travel regularly to both DC and Tehran and meet senior officials who strongly deny this. Anthony was actually in the same room as me when I asked a very senior Iranian official if US-Iran cooperation would continue, and he laughed it off and he said, you know, he declined there was coordination to begin with. And of course, the Americans in DC, they say the same thing. We talk to the Iranians about the nuclear file, but we don't discuss operations in Iraq. But when you go to Baghdad, it's a very different story. And especially with the liberation of Tikrit and some of the areas north of Baghdad, where you had the US Air Force clearing ISIS positions for Iranian-backed forces to then move on the ground. Last but not least, I spoke about intra-Sunni conflict, but I think we should recognize there's a big escalation in intra-Shia conflict. It's not as violent, of course, but there's potential for things to get ugly very quickly. Just a bit of background. In 2014, when ISIS rose, the Iraqi army collapsed. It was ordinary people, people like this old man, who picked up arms and defended Baghdad, which was under threat. And I was in Baghdad on June the 10th. ISIS were 30 kilometers away, and they were shelling and firing mortars into the city. People thought the capital would fall. In fact, the Americans assessed it could have fallen within 72 hours. But people rose up when the army collapsed. And they didn't just push back ISIS from Baghdad. They, in fact, cleared some of the areas I showed you in the first slide. However, amongst these people, and in fact, powerful militia groups took advantage of the groundswell in anti-ISIS feeling, and they began recruiting and expanding their networks. These groups are allied to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is Iran's elite fighting force, which operates outside of Iran, in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon and across the region. There's really no equivalent to this force in the Western world. In America, think of it as, you know, the CIA merged with the State Department, merged with, you know, Delta Force and the Special Forces, merged with ExxonMobil, Walmart, and large corporations. And this is not an exaggeration. The IRGC control up to 30% of Iran's economy. They have vast economic stakes in telecommunications and construction. And of course, militarily, they're the ones who go to Syria, go to Iraq, go to Lebanon to fight Iran's wars. And these people are veterans of the Iraq-Iran war. The people who control Syria, Iraq, Lebanon policy in Iran is not the Ministry of Foreign Relations, the Foreign Ministry, it's the IRGC. And their proxies in Iraq are going to demand a stake in any post-ISIS settlement. And these groups are increasingly challenging the central government in Baghdad. And of course, they're going to be a big headache for Baghdad and the international community. Now, tens of thousands of them, like these men, are going to drop their arms after ISIS. They're going to go back to their families and the younger generation. Many of them will be integrated officially into the Iraqi security services. They'll be federal police and federal soldiers. But tens of thousands of others won't. And powerful commanders are going to resist any US-backed Iraqi government attempt to demobilize or integrate them into the Iraqi security forces. And I'll end on that note and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Haider. We'll have a short Q&A session here before I throw open questions to the audience. But I suppose the first thing that I'd like to get you to expand on, Haider, is where, as you pointed out during your talk, it's not just a military campaign, it's also a campaign about ideas. But allied with that is also issues of governance and, more importantly, poor governance, which provides fertile ground for these ideas to take root. Could you just give some idea of your thoughts about what the shortfalls are in regional governance structures, most particularly in Iraq, and what really practically could be done to make better governance in a national sense in these countries, perhaps starting off with Iraq and making a more general comment about other countries in the region?
I mean, in one word, the answer is decentralization. A big part of the problem in Iraq, which gave rise to ISIS, was the central government's obsession. And I'm not blaming this current government. It's a legacy of the state system, the nation states in Iraq, even before Saddam Hussein. The idea of the government wanting to exert its writ, influence, presence, and power, you know, from the north of Iraq in the Kurdish mountains to the south of Iraq, where the oil fields are. And this was actually counterproductive. It's especially if the government's policies antagonize the local population. And one of the big problems in Iraq was the former Prime Minister Maliki would appoint hacks, political friends, to very senior military positions in Mosul. And many of these would be sectarian Shia army officers, which antagonized the local population. And in Mosul, in fact, even before the 700 ISIS fighters came into the city, it was ordinary people, citizens, who had enough of the status quo and, you know, stormed Iraqi army barracks and told them to leave. Thankfully, this is, you know, I'm talking about 2 years ago. Now the government, and again with the help of the international community, is very serious about decentralization and devolving powers from the government. And in fact, half a dozen ministries now have been dissolved, three or four have been merged with others, and a lot of the powers of the central government are being given to provincial governments and provincial councils. Of course, this can't happen with territory that's currently being occupied by ISIS, but it is happening elsewhere in Iraq, and I think it's a very good step in the right direction.
And do you think that kind of model of decentralized governance is the kind of thing that can be exported as part of a longer-term solution to other conflicts such as Syria, or perhaps a way of other governments reforming before these crises hit?
Absolutely. I think it's already happening in parts of Syria where the Syrian regime is recognizing, you know, of course, not Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but other rebels grudgingly, of course, accepting they are the new leaders in their local cities. You know, however this conflict ends in Syria, and it's looking more and more likely it's going to end with the regime in place in Damascus, that regime is never, ever going to be able to exert influence as it once did. And it's already lost those territories, and it's very unlikely for it to win them back. In Iraq, it's slightly different because the government realizes decentralization and devolving power as a matter of policy and something which is the good thing to do. In Syria, it's going to be the thing you have to do. It's not a matter of choice. But certainly, yes, the borders aren't going to be redrawn between Syria and Iraq. The Sykes-Picot order, I think, is resilient, is going to remain. But certainly, there'll be a reordering of politics within Syria and Iraq.
And you also mentioned about Iran's influence in Iraq and the changing dynamics between Iran and the United States. How do you see regional states viewing the likely outcome of Iraq? What would regional states such as Saudi Arabia and further afield with Egypt and even Turkey, what would they view as an acceptable Iraqi state, or a state that they would be confident in establishing closer relationships with than they currently have?
One of the big problems in the Middle East and in Iraq in particular is Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, Egypt, they don't want the same thing for Iraq. And in fact, sometimes they lobby even, you know, think tanks in the West to fight each other and to lobby against each other. In Iraq, I think the common denominator of what, and you know, just to be a bit more blunt about this, what the Sunni Arab states want from Iraq is for Iraq to be withdrawn from the Iranian orbit of influence. This is the one thing, regardless of you know, the different groups they're funding and the political fighting, they don't want to see an Arab capital to be under the influence of Iran. Of course, this is what's happening now, Iraq, this is a historical anomaly. It's the first time in almost 1,000 years that an Arab country is run by Arab Shia, even though they're the majority and it was elections and they voted for the current leadership. It's something very difficult for the Arab world to stomach. And I think just, you know, on a psychological level, they're having problems conceptualizing Baghdad is no longer as it once was before 2003.
I mean, how do, in a practical sense, do you think it's realistic for them to ever think that the world or the region, their part of the world, can ever go back to approximating what it once was? Or do they really just have to intellectually accommodate a new regional order?
I mean, it's clearly not going to go back to the way it once was, but it's a two-way problem. The way the Shias governed Iraq, the violence, the sectarianism, the, you know, misguided security policies, and just if I can elaborate slightly on this, we had some cases, again, this is under the former prime minister, I'm not talking about the current government, but we're dealing with his legacy even today. After explosions in a particular area, federal forces would come in, arrest 300, 400, 500 at a time, military-aged young Iraqi Sunnis. Yes, they would catch the terrorists, two or three of them, they'd be in jail, but alongside them would be hundreds of innocents. And these were the people who were being radicalized in prison. So don't get me wrong, the Shia failed spectacularly in Iraq. But the other side, which is the Saudi, Qatari, Arab, GCC, they pushed Iraq's Shia towards Iran. Pushed is a very polite way of saying it. They rejected them from the outset. They refused to acknowledge the post-2003 constitution, the post-2003 political process, the post-2003 political elections, as an Iraqi myself speaking. If I want to go to Iran, I can go to the embassy or consulate, within 2 hours, get a visa, $100 round trip, and I'd be respected. Going to the Arab world is extremely difficult, takes weeks, you need wasta, you need connections to diplomats. So I know this is not political, but think of this just socially for Iraqis. Healthcare, education, want to go on a holiday, they can't turn to the Arab world because the Arab world has very firmly shut its doors. In Jordan, they ask you point blank, are you Shia or are you Sunni? I mean, they don't ask me because I'm a dual national and I go with my British passport. But, you know, Iraqi citizens are very, very unwelcome. So two things need to happen to summarize the answer to this question. The Arab world needs to deal with and understand the new political realities in Iraq. But the politicians in Baghdad, specifically the Shia Islamists who have governed since 2003, also need to extend their arms. And we have some positive news now. The next foreign minister, the nominee, is actually a member of the royal family, the royal Iraqi family. So he's an Arab Sunni. And if he is appointed as the next foreign minister, I think this will send a good signal to the Arab world that Iraq is ready to engage, but it takes two to tango, and it needs to come from both sides.
I mean, it's interesting you say Iraq having to send signals to the Arab world being an Arab country itself. I suppose that comes down to this other question of issues of identity. Is it, how difficult is it going to be for Iraq to establish a sense of Iraqi national identity amongst its disparate sectarian groups, its disparate ethnic groups, its other tribal identities? Is that the kind of challenge that you think the Iraqi government is able to overcome?
It's a big challenge. I don't want to downplay the problem. Sectarian divisions are real. But as I tried to show in the presentation and what we're seeing on the ground in Iraq, there is a lot of cross-sectarian mobilization. This current government is moving, the current Iraqi government is moving and reaching out to Sunnis. The hope is for the end of the year to have 30,000 Sunni tribal fighters fighting alongside the government forces. And of course, it goes without saying, the government forces itself are mixed. The Shia dominated, yes, but they have many Sunnis at the rank and file and officer corps level. But of course, the violence we're seeing makes sectarian identity more resonant. It makes it more important. In the absence of a state, in the absence of security, people fall back to these tribal, familial, and sectarian identities. The hope is, of course, after ISIS, it will be much more easier to do this. And, you know, it has to be said, even during the darkest days of Iraq, 2007, 2008, and by the way, as bad as the violence is now, it was nothing compared to 2007, 2008. But even in 2007, when the Iraqi football team won the Asian Cup, there was an incredible, from the north to the south, you know, a sectarian war still going on, don't get me wrong, people killing each other on the streets, death squads roaming around, jihadi terrorists roaming around. But the Iraqi people, ordinary men, women, and children were in the streets celebrating. And this is why I say the Sykes-Picot order is going to be resilient. Nationalism exists in Iraq, a lot of Shias and Sunnis, and it will be more. And of course, as you know, identity is very fluid. In a better security landscape, these would be more important.
I'd now like to just get your thoughts on more security focus. We've, as you had the with the maps and the figures there about the degree to which Islamic State has been degraded both by the US and other forces in Syria. It's certainly on a downward glide path, but President Obama said the mission was to degrade and destroy Islamic State. Do you think in Iraq, and perhaps just confine your comments more to Iraq, particularly given the fact, as you pointed out, Islamic State is a particularly Iraqi organisation, do you think it can effectively be destroyed in Iraq, or will there always be some element of these same kind of people who've never reconciled themselves to the new reality, new political reality?
Tough question, Roger. ISIS, the so-called state, yes, it can be destroyed. The elements which make up ISIS, and it has to be said here, I didn't get a chance to speak about this during the presentation, initially it wasn't just, you know, jihadists who were on the march fighting for the caliphate. We had Arab nationalists, leftists, people who call themselves the resistance, those who fought the Americans in post-2003 Iraqi government. Of course, the Ba'athists themselves had very powerful insurgency and groups. Together they made up ISIS. And I actually asked a Ba'athist, who shall remain nameless, I said to him, what was the game plan in 2014? What did you want to do in Iraq? And his answer was, this guy is a senior Iraqi politician, and again, it shows how many have one foot in government, one foot in the resistance, so-called resistance. He said the Ba'athists wanted to stab ISIS in the back once they came to Baghdad. That was the game plan. We take Baghdad, and then we turn on the jihadists. But then he laughed, and he said the problem was, in Mosul, as soon as the city fell, the Ba'athists put up pictures of Saddam. You know, ex-army officers started roaming the streets, and within 24 hours, they were brutally shut down. 64 senior Ba'athists were arrested. 4 very senior officials were executed. So ISIS turned on the Ba'athists before the Ba'athists could turn on ISIS. So ISIS can be destroyed. For there no longer to be an ISIS problem in whatever shape or form that may be after things get better, it will depend on how well the Iraqi government can reach out to the Ba'athists, to people who in 2003 lost everything. Many of them may not have been ideological pro-Saddam, you know, who were committed to the regime. Many of them are professionals. And in 2003, they were told, you're no longer welcome in this country. And that hurts. And this was both an American and Iraqi decision. You had tens of thousands of officers told you have no future in this country. The way, and again, I don't want to just blame the Americans, the way the Americans and Iraqis dealt with them was very harsh. And it laid the foundation for groups like Al-Qaeda in Iraq and ISIS to dominate later.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Haider. Again, as I said, I could probably ask you 1,000 questions, but I've been with Haider for a couple of days now, also in Canberra, so I've already asked him about 4,000 questions, so I won't hog him any longer, and I'll throw it open to questions from the floor. First of all, the first question the front here will be from Mr. Talal Yassin, who's Chairman of the Council of Australian Arab Relations. So, Talal, first question to you.
Thank you very much, Roger. And very good to meet you, Haider. I would like, should I stand, sit?
However you wish.
I think I'll sit. As you mentioned, I'm the Chair of the Council of Australia Relations, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade Government Advisory Board. We are proud and privileged to have speakers of the calibre of Haider in association with the Lowy Institute here in Australia. It's very rarely we get that depth of insight. We all watch the news and we all watch the programs, but that depth of insight and that understanding of what's happening in Syria, Iraq, and the Middle East generally. We exist to actually promote cultural dialogue, social, cultural, economic dialogue, and we're very proud to have this flagship program with yourself and other speakers. My first question, my first comment and then question, you and I have a lot in common in Jordan. They don't like me either, and I don't know why, and I have an Australian passport. So we have that in common to start with. The second one is, with organisations like myself and my organisation, the Lowy Institute, shouldn't call it my organisation, the government organisation, but the organisation I lead at this point, and others in Australia, we're seeking to humanise the conflict in the sense that we see a lot of death and a lot of destruction. And sure, we can talk about political forces and ISIS and groups, but at the end of the day, it's people killing other people for whatever reason. How can we do that in an effective way? Or is there no way of doing that to kind of deal with our guilt of like people chopping up each other? Is it just the nature of man, I guess?
It's a very tough, philosophical, deep historic question. I don't know if I can answer this question. Physically, it's very difficult. And for understandable reasons, government agencies and non-governmental organizations are very afraid of being in places like in Iraq and Syria. So just, I think everyone in this room understands the importance of the type of work you're talking about. The challenge is how do you do this amidst the violence? And I don't have an answer to this. And I think, you know, governments don't have a good answer for this. Sorry, it's really tough.
Thanks, Tala. Once you get the microphone, if you just state your name and organisation, if you belong to one.
Rob Thomas from LFG. I'd be interested to see how you see the decentralisation working in Iraq. You know, because you would be worried that you know the disparity of income between the south and north is going to cause a lot of issues. And all that will happen is they'll turn around and become tribal, nearly like Afghanistan. So I'd be interested to see how you could actually practically see decentralization working going forward.
It would, of course, all depend on which currently exists, actually, a revenue sharing program. So even in, again, I'm going to speak in blunt terms, even in Sunni provinces where there are no natural resources, the oil, which happens to be where the Shia live, is being distributed fairly. In each individual provincial budget, they are allocated petrodollars depending on the size of this population. And in fact, it's why decentralization makes much more sense, workable decentralization where it is distributed. And of course, the money doesn't end up with the people in both Sunni areas and Shia areas, because the Shia politicians and the Sunni politicians, one thing they have in common is the corruption. They're both as corrupt as each other.
Reassuring.
But, yeah, but decentralization, and I'm not here to defend the Iraqi government, but this makes much more sense than division and partition, and this idea of we as in the West or the international community, saying, you know, these people are savages, they can't live with each other, and good fences make good neighbors. There are unfortunately some Sunnis who want more autonomy, as the Kurds have in the north. The problem with this is if you say we want our own iqlim, our own region, the Shia and the South say, well, why should I fund you with my oil? And in fact, that way they will starve, because many of these areas are open desert, there are no natural resources. But when wealth is distributed equally, it doesn't matter. And in fact, is distributed so equally, the distribution I'm talking about, not the way it's spent, the distribution is distributed so equally that the people of Basra in the south of Iraq, where 90% of Iraq's oil is located, are furious. I mean, they're not up in arms, thankfully, but they're actually calling for more autonomy. Basra is one of the most underdeveloped provinces in Iraq. It's the richest province in terms of natural resources. Some of the schools have no walls, no tables, no chairs. People sit outside in the heat, on the ground. So they're saying, why is our wealth going to other areas?
There's a man in the red shirt here.
Firas Naji from the Iraqi Cultural Festival. And as a member of the Iraqi community, I would like to welcome you, Haidar, here. Thank you for your presentation. You highlighted challenges, great challenges currently exist, but those challenges probably will be even worse after ISIS is gone. So you have the influence of the militias, for example, from Shia's end, from the there's a retribution and revenge, Sunnis and sectarian-wise. The Kurds, which you haven't mentioned, they have their own ambitions for independence, so forth. And the political process already is struggling. Like we know, follow the news, the Iraqi parliament now is in disarray, you know, it's dysfunctional. And the government, Abadi, is not in a better shape. He's struggling to reform the government. So they are struggling to actually even deal with the current problems, let alone those even worse problems after ISIS is gone. So maybe now with ISIS, there's a bit more united front. The question is, a lot of commentators think the issue, the fault, is in the political process and the constitution and whatever system set up after the Americans invaded, came into Iraq. So the question is, what do you think? Do we need a new political system to deal with these challenges?
Absolutely. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of Iraqis on the streets. And again, this is cross-sectarian, Shias, Sunnis in Baghdad. They're all protesting against the, interestingly, the nature of the political order. So the political system in terms of having elections, a constitution, yes, of course, can be amended. The outcome is not going to be very different in terms of majority, minority groups. But a lot of people are angry about the ethno-sectarian quotas that are in place. It's not official like it is in Lebanon, but in Iraq, this idea of muhasasa, of dishing out government ministries and departments, depending not on your competence or how qualified you are, but purely based on which sect you represent, is, I think, yeah, it's the system since 2003. This definitely needs to be changed, absolutely, yeah. And in fact, if I can just add, the Islamists, again on both sides of the sectarian divide, the Shia Islamists and the Sunni Islamists, they've failed so bad to provide basic services to their people that one of the unifying slogans of this I don't want to call it anti-government protest, pro-reform, I think is more accurate. The pro-reform protesters, one of the most famous slogans is بِإِسْمِ الدِّينِ, in the name of religion, dot, dot, dot. So they'll have slogans, in the name of religion, they stole our wealth. In the name of religion, they destroyed our country. And this is new, by the way. This is a new awareness amongst Iraqi youth, my generation, who have realized this Shia-Sunni trumped-up game is being played by their politicians. And on both sides, the Shia politicians and the Sunni politicians are using sectarian identity for very narrow-minded, short-term, you know, I need to win votes and I need to get into power. So the system, I think, is changing in terms of ethno-sectarian order, but it's changing the context of young people. And there's actually been research done by an institute in Beirut. We just looked at the age groups of the current protesters in Iraq, some of the people who led to the disarray you're speaking about in parliament. And in fact, as we speak, they are surrounding government ministries. Government employees cannot go to their offices because of the protesters who have had enough. 70% of them, over two-thirds, are 29 and younger. These are people who are young children or young teenagers during 2003. The legacy of Saddam, the memory of the Ba'ath, which is used as an excuse by the current crop of leadership, the current political class, is much less excusable. These people don't remember some of the trials the other generation. So in fact, we are seeing a generational shift, but this is going to take time because there are vested interests, political parties who have vested interest in the ethno-sectarian corrupt system, and they're very wary about losing some of their power and influence. But it's going to be forced, and it is being forced on them by the people.
Thanks. Sorry. Judy Betts from Sydney University. Would you be able to explain what you see as Saudi objectives in the region? Why are they playing the role that they're playing? And you talked about the books that were being circulated. Could you give us an idea of the sorts of ideas included in those books?
I mean, I'll answer the second question first. And by the way, I know these books are ISIS books and the official Saudi books, but trust me when I say they're being taught everywhere, and probably some of them you'll find in Australian universities or even mosques and certainly private homes. It's a very backward, bigoted interpretation of Islam. It was initially a reform movement, but it's a black and white us and them mentality. Jews and Christians are monkeys and pigs. They are infidels. Even other Muslims, by the way, who pray differently or have some, you know, different doctrinal beliefs are considered apostates. Apostates who you can take their property, rape their women, steal their goods. This is an ideology. I'm not talking about ISIS, by the way. I'm talking about this Wahhabi Salafi ideology. It's being taught to children from primary school age until universities. So even some of the most prestigious universities in Saudi Arabia are teaching this. And of course, Muslims from all over the world, including Indonesia, Malaysia, go to Saudi Arabia because it's seen as more prestigious, authentic Arab Islam. the point I'm making is when you go through this education and through this mentality of us versus them and everyone else is either, even if he's a fellow Muslim, he's an apostate who I can kill, or he's an infidel who must be killed, it's not difficult for groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda to push them over the edge in terms of converting this mentality and ideology into violence, into if I believe. So kids who go through this system are very easily recruitable by terrorist organizations who actually have a very valid, in a twisted way, they have a very valid argument, groups like ISIS. They say, and this is why their ideology is very cogent, and it's not one that should be underestimated. They tell these Muslims who have gone through this radicalized education, they say, fair enough if you believe it, but you need to practice what you preach. It's no good just being books. You need to put this into practice. And this is why they're able to draw from 70, or I think 75 countries worldwide. In terms of Saudi, the state, the government's objective, it's as any other nation state, it wants to extend its influence, it wants to have hegemony in the region. And it's not just Saudi in the region who does this. Iran, in a very different way, instrumentalizes religion and sectarian identity. And of course, it's not a coincidence that Iran and Saudi are the main groups now fighting in the Middle East, or fighting proxy wars in Syria and in Iraq. And this is something I always say in terms of the proxy conflict. Imagine how peaceful the region would be if Saudi Arabia and Iran had to fight each other directly, you know, army to army, state to state. It would be peaceful. The region would be peaceful because neither Saudi nor Iran would risk their own security and their own stability. But unfortunately, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, these places are expendable. Iraqis, Syrians, Lebanese, Palestinians, who are they to the Iranians and the Saudis? They're pawns, and that's why the region is on fire.
Victoria Luck, what do you think Iran and America want from each other at this time, other than to defeat ISIS?
The territorial integrity of Syria and Iraq, in a nutshell. Both countries, and actually I think this is a positive sign for the region. If the great Satan, America, and the state sponsor of terrorism, Iran, and this is how they're viewed by each other, if they can both agree on, you know, big picture, fundamental questions of the region, and one of the most fundamental is the nation state, is the current borders, are they viable? That both these countries can agree to this is, I think, a very good sign. Of course, they want different things from those states, but I'm actually not sure where America's interests are in the territorial integrity of Iraq and Syria. And in fact, many Iraqis and Syrians will say quietly the Americans want to see a breakup. But for the Iranians, it's obvious. For this, even the Saudis, by the way, the Saudis and the Saudis also want the territorial integrity of Iraq, and they want it for very obvious reasons. In their own countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, in Turkey, even there's no homogenous group. Iran isn't all Persians. Persians are 50% or even a minority in Iran. Iran and the region, and of course America, would not want to see the breakup of Iraq or Syria, because it could open Pandora's box and lead to far bloodier conflicts. Because once that door is open, there'll literally be no stop. Which, you know, there was a satirical piece in The Onion, I think, once, which said the solution is to have 300,000 countries in the Middle East. Because it's true. I mean, in Iraq, if you have, and this is why I personally believe, as an Iraqi and also as an analyst, that division is a very bad idea. If you have a Shia Sunni Kurdish state, you know, forget the idea, the reality that we can't neatly divide these areas. Sunnis live in the south with the Shia as brothers. Shia live north of Baghdad alongside Sunnis. Kurds are living in Baghdad. And in Baghdad itself, we have intermarriages. Sunnis married to Shias, Shias married to Sunnis. You can't suddenly tell families, you know, you're on two separate sides of a border and you need to, it would lead to ethnic cleansing on a very big scale.
Something else we have in common, the Lebanese experience that you quoted. So my background and heritage is Lebanese, and some of the things you mentioned about the way they split is still done and still absolutely disgrace in terms of governance. I would not like to see that in Iraq continue. I'd like to, with a lot of passion and very little facts, challenge one of your view of Sykes-Picot and its resilience in the face of what's happening today. I saw the Onion piece, it was very funny, but I certainly wouldn't be on I guess, arguing what you're arguing, which is that resilience will stand as much as you'd like to see it, because it's very much like the Lebanese circumstance. We're a nation of tribes and continue to be so no matter what Versace suits we wear and what flights we do and what education we have. We still are tribes and are divided. You know, and in fact, you can say the Lebanon is actually a more honest representation, because they clearly say, you're Sunni, you're Shia, you're Maronite, this is the way they're being honest about it in that sense. Having said that, I can't see, and I want to put those two together, and Lebanon as the example, I can't see how Iraqis and Syrians can live and work together, even though they did under dictators, enforced effectively under Ba'athist, what we pretend to be Ba'athist strategy, our policy anyway, when there is no dictator, when there are elections, when there are sectarian splits, again, harking back to the Lebanese example of Sunni and Shia politicians saying, you must come to me because the other side is going to kill you, how can those nation states actually survive all this and go back together? Sure, if the great Satan, the biggest supporter of terrorism and the biggest incubator of terrorism, otherwise called the Wahhabis, if they can come together and agree something, all three, potentially. But how's that going to go into longer term? The Iraqi nationalism, the Syrian nationalism, the Lebanese nationalism doesn't actually exist in the way Australian nationalism exists or American nationalism exists. It exists in a very different way. So I go back to the question. I think my view is, as I say, with a lot of passion and very little facts, in 50 years there will not be these nations we call Iraq, Syria and Lebanon.
It's a valid argument, and in fact, another thing we share in common is our dual or multi identities. I'm also British and I'm also Iraqi, and this is why the question of Sykes-Picot is quite personal. The Brits drew the Iraqi borders. Look, I'm not of the belief that colonial borders drawn up in the early 20th century are sacred and that we must defend them to the last drop of our blood. I'm saying this as just somebody, a simple man, who looks at a map and sees the tough environment we are in and the countries we are surrounded by, and recognizes Lebanon and Iraq are very weak states surrounded by much more powerful states. And that's why I think the Sykes-Picot border is resilient in a negative sense, because I think the alternative will be much worse. The difference was in the 20th century. It was white men in suits, meeting in secret in London and Paris, and with rulers and pens drawing up borders. Today, it's not going to be men in suits in the West. It's going to be angry, armed men on the ground who are going to draw borders with their blood, not on ink and paper.
Thanks. We've got time for two more over here. So,
Peter Green. What does Russia want in this region?
I think Roger can answer that question. I'm not a Russia specialist.
Just my perspective, they, as Haider said, they want to maintain the territorial integrity of Syria. They understand Syria. They've been there for decades, militarily, politically. They also understand that there can only be a political solution to this, so they need to force everybody to the negotiating table, but they need to force everybody to the negotiating table with them in the ascendancy, and I think that's what they've done at the moment. And you could argue that they have allowed, by keeping the Azaz corridor, so about 100 kilometres of the Syrian-Turkish border open, so Turkey has an ability still to service its clients in the country, that's given them a degree of equality at the negotiating table. If Russia wanted to make that the military main effort, they could cut off that corridor if they so chose to. They don't. So I think they have relatively medium-term aims. They still want to maintain influence in Syria, as they have for decades up till now. They want to maintain the territorial integrity of Syria, and they want to have the upper hand in any negotiations that maintains a pro-Moscow and a pro-Tehran regime operating from Damascus. Exactly what that looks like and exactly what the relationship between the centre and the periphery looks like, I think they're up to negotiation, but I think their aims are relatively limited in Syria.
Of course, just to very quickly add to that, jihadists for them is a domestic problem as well. It's not just something happening in the Middle East. They have a very big jihadi problem that they're fighting on their own doorsteps.
And certainly I've been going back to the region looking at Syria question regularly since just after the uprisings, and certainly The Russians have, from very, very early on, seen this amongst perhaps a dozen reasons for being solidly engaged in the region. They've seen it as a locus of jihadis, particularly from the Caucasus. So they've seen it in counter-terrorism terms from really the earliest days. They saw that if there was a nationalist uprising, the window for that closed quite quickly and it got overtaken by events. So I think they've got medium-term aims.
Roger, can I just very quickly comment on the question about borders, which is something I forgot to mention, and why I hope you're wrong. I understand your argument, and I genuinely hope you're wrong. Because once that ball gets rolling, forget the bloodshed between the sects or the races or the ethnic groups about where my border starts and where your border ends. Let's assume that this is done peacefully with no ethnic cleansing, and we have these states in Iraq and Syria. The problem is then with the Shia states in Iraq, the debate is going to be who's more Shia, which group is more Shia, which school of thought is more Shia. In the Sunni states, it will be which version of Sunni Islam and which school of Sunni Islam. And that's why I think, even though it was a hilarious article, the 300,000 states, I immediately identified with it, because that will never stop. And once let's say we'll have three Shia states in Iraq, and then it'll be about families, it'll be about tribes, and that, yeah, in a nutshell, that's why I hope you're wrong.
Okay, just the last question here.
Marnie Wright from DFAT. Just on the subject of territorial integrity, post-ISIS, how content do you think the Kurdish leadership and Kurdish people will be with the level of autonomy they currently have in the arrangement?
I mean, I just came back from Kurdistan and had extensive discussions with the Kurdish leadership. Their problem is a big one, and it's also geopolitical realities. As an Iraqi, I understand the Kurdish right for self-determination, but the Kurds themselves can't tell us, as Iraqis, where their state is and where their boundaries are. And if you want to have an independent state, in fact, one of the, at the very basic level, the whole point of a state, a nation state, the Weberian definition, is to have a monopoly on violence within your borders. You need a monopoly on violence, and you need borders. The Kurds don't have that. And it gets even further complicated, because the Kurds, they'll say Kirkuk, which is another province outside of the Kurdish regional government, they'll say Kirkuk is our Jerusalem. It's something that has to be part of Kurdistan. Kirkuk is heavily mixed, Turkmen, Arabs. What do you do with the Arabs? What do you do with the Turkmen? But then politically it gets even more complicated, because the Kurdish leadership will lose out in terms of balance of power if that is included in Kurdistan, the state. So I think, and I think a lot of Kurds realize this, but a lot of my Kurdish friends certainly realize this, that the debate for independence is one of distraction. The Kurds, the corruption issues are as bad as they are. Some of the petty intra-Kurdish conflict is as bad as it is in the rest of the country. And it's a classic deflection. Let's play the nationalist card and let me keep my people busy for a while my cronies continue siphoning off the country's state resources. In Kurdistan, and this is the blunt truth, the debate on independence is just a political distraction by the Kurdish leadership.
Okay, listen, thanks very much, Haider. And I know we could have... I know we could have had a lot more time speaking to Haider as well, but it's been, from my perspective and certainly the Institute's perspective, and I'd like to thank the Council for Australian Arab Relations for providing the funding for bringing Haider out, and he came on the recommendation of Anthony, who was telling me about this person that he met in Tehran, and I'd known about Haider from his social media, his intense social media activity and commentary, which is always excellent to read. But Anthony said this is a sharp, younger mind that we need to take the opportunity to listen to, and certainly he's proven to be everything that Anthony said and more, and he certainly impressed people in Canberra when we had him speaking to a range of people down there yesterday. So on behalf of myself, the Institute and the Council, thanks again very much, Haider. And Haider, hopefully we'll be able to hang around here for a bit, and if people have got individual questions that they couldn't ask from the floor, by all means, take the opportunity now. So thank you very much.